found this on Ganarum. Ganamir Ni.
What is it?
Well, it's,
It's in the vaults.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan. With me is co-host Guy Davis, and today we have a very special guest with us today, Bonnie Moss. She is a co-producer on Larry Nemechek's Con of Wrath and personal friend to Leonard Nimoy. So welcome, Bonnie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. And Larry Nemechek actually introduced us a little bit on Twitter right after the last time I spoke with him on the show. How long had you known Leonard Nimoy in person? Because I know Larry had mentioned to me that you're a longtime friend of Nimoy.
Yes, and I would say it would span about a 35-year friendship. I first saw him in 1976. We first met in 1979 to converse. And, of course, it was intermittent over that 35 years. We were 3,000 on separate coasts. And, of course, he had a career, and I had school, and we led very separate lives. And I was one of many fans who had contact with him. But every time we did see each other, he knew my name. We met in circumstances beyond Star Trek conventions, at art events, at his theater appearances. So he knew I was a fan beyond Star Trek, even though that's where things got started, so to speak. And I think the fact that we saw each other in different venues and we had similar interests, and contrary to popular belief, that I did not stalk him. We formed a trust and a friendship, and we had similar sense of humor and interests, and I got along with some of his friends. We had a couple mutual friends, and it was all good. It was a really special thing, and I really have great memories from it, and I really miss him a lot.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, everyone, I'm sure, that was a fan of his missed him a lot after his passing. But, I mean, it's got to be even more so for you since you've known him on and off for that span of time.
Mm-hmm.
Larry had mentioned to me that you were, like, an avid collector of some of his early photography. Like, when did he, like, start, like, or when did you start collecting his photography or
okay. Well, I'll answer both. He started as a photographer at the age of 13. He's always had an interest in photography. This was with him his entire life. And the last several years of his life, when he was, you know, less focused on conventions and some of his other pursuits, of course, was still involved with Star Trek through the movies. Photography really was his primary creative pursuit in those final years. But he first fell in love with it as a 13-year-old, and he developed his own prints in the family tenement bathroom. And he said, you know, he lived with his parents and his grandparents and his mother, and he would make them all very angry because there was only one bathroom, and he was developing photographs when they all wanted to use it. But he would save up his allowance or his pennies, or he would work odd jobs and would run to the photography shop nearby and buy the chemicals. And he made his own enlarger, was a very creative guy in that. So the interest was always there. He even studied photography at UCLA. Not a lot of people know that. He studied under Robert Heineken, who was a very highly regarded conceptual photographer. Mm-hmm. And so he took it seriously. He studied it seriously. And ultimately, he was accepted as a serious conceptual photographer. And this pleased him a great deal, but it was no fluke. It was no sideline. It was something that he pursued and studied and perfected over many, many years. How I came to his photography, ironically, was, you know, again, through Star Trek. So many things, you know, the portal of entry, so to speak, frequently is Star Trek. I was a fan when the original series was running, which dates me now. You know, now that they're talking 50th, you say you were on, you were watching it when it was on, they know you're at least 50 plus, which sucks in some ways, but also gives you some dubious stature. We call ourselves.
There's no shame in that.
I don't think there's any shame in that at all.
Okay. God bless you. We call ourselves the originals.
No doubt.
Original series, original run, original time frame, et cetera, et cetera. Then when we've had a few, we call ourselves relics. So
that's a great episode.
Yeah, it is.
That's what we feel like now, but in a good way, in a good way.
You survived Franklin and the transporter loop?
Yeah, there you go.
I brought this up before with David and the guys. I am 2 days younger than Will Wheaton, so it's whenever I was 14 when Next Gen came out. I already had 14 years of the original series, I didn't watch it in its first run. I watched it in the 70s syndication cycle a lot and grew up on it. And here in Denver, they would run it at 10 o'clock at night, so I would stay up late and I'd sneak the black and white TV down into my basement room and turn it on and watch Star Trek and all that stuff. So
what drew you to Star Trek in the original series on the original run? Like, was it well advertised and you just like, did you start watching it at the beginning or was it just on, you heard about it, then you started watching it in the middle of the run? Like, how did you meet Star Trek?
It was in the previews, the upcoming season, when they started showing, and it was in color. Remember, at that time, shows were still in black and white, and some were in color, and some were transitioning from black and white to color, like Beverly Hillbillies and the Andy Griffith Show. They were transitioning. So the fact it was in color got your attention immediately, and of course, I was young. I remember distinctly the boldness of it, those primary colors. Star Trek was not in pastels. Star Trek was not in, shadow. It was red, blue, gold. It popped. It popped off the screen. It still does. But imagine back then when you're used to black and white, and then you see this, and then you see, and I was in the Deep South. Had not seen a lot of African Americans on television, had not seen a lot of Asians on television. Now, nor had anybody nationally, but even in one's daily life, this was not happening. So that caught your eye, again, I'm speaking from a personal point of view now. So I remember going, wow, these are different people in a different place. It's visually stunning. Of course, I'd have just said, cool. I wouldn't have found those words for it back then. And I remember thinking, I'm going to watch that. That looks cool, And, of course, I was 10. I guess I was 10 years old, 9, 10 years old. And so my age through the run was like 10 to 13 or 9 to 12, something like that. So I started out just wanting to see the visuals. But by the time I ended, I was like, these guys are pretty good looking. And, I went from kid to thinking Spock was kind of dreamy, So
to teenager,
Yeah, it ran that gamut there. So, but I do distinctly remember and of course every episode started with the NBC Peacock, which told you that it was in color. That you had those logos to tell you it was in color, because otherwise –
You wouldn't have noticed if it was in color if they didn't tell you. It's like, oh, this is black and white. Oh, wait, no, it's in color.
Exactly. They were touting it. It was like, this theater is air conditioned, back in the 50s, because that wasn't the standard. And so this was saying, this is in color, and the Peacock, and they took that music later, I think, for Scooby-Doo or something. But, you know, they had that music. And so I remember just you would want to see that peacock man, you know, to see that pop of color and then know that show coming on was going to be in color. So that's what I remember from the original series.
I think that was something else that they did so that if you had a black and white TV, you could sit there and go, look at all these shows that are in color. Hey, let's go get a color TV. Because you kept seeing the peacock in black and white, you know.
You're absolutely right. And, of course, a color TV back then was a piece of furniture.
Yep.
I mean, they were consoles, you know, huge. And so it was a major investment. We were the first family on the block to get a color TV. And I remember the whole neighborhood coming over, you know, like it was like a home theater.
Standing outside your living room window looking in. It's like, ooh.
Exactly. Got colors. Exactly. But we segued, didn't we? Wow. Imagine that.
I was just thinking about how, you know, it's only been 50 years since Star Trek was on the air. And you think that when that was on, the idea of visually communicating to one another was science fiction. And yet here all three of us are in three different parts of the nation, literally visually talking to each other only 50 years later.
View screen on.
Yeah, view screen on.
Mr. Sulu.
Yeah.
I'm my own Mr. Sulu. I've got to do it myself.
Yeah. Sorry, man. We don't have Sulu to help you there.
Actually, it'd be Uhura. She was the communications officer. Turn on the TV. Get the communications
Where's
going.
The remote.
I don't know their phone number.
Has a little. Your earpieces are a little too big, David. You need to.
You need the little reader.
Yeah, get it down there.
Yeah, but this is noise canceling. Yeah, I don't know if Uhura's is noise canceling. She had to listen to Kirk. If she was noise canceling Kirk, I don't think he would be very happy. So when did you start collecting his photography? Like, when did you know? Like, cause you started watching Star Trek when
that's
you were
where we came from. Yes, of course, from watching Star Trek, there was the Leonard Nimoy Association of Fans. He had a fan club, and so I joined his fan club, and it was called the LNAF. It lasted for many, many years. It started in 66 or 67, and I think it went through like 1979, at least that incarnation of the club. And Louise Stange was the president, and she and Leonard, of course, remained good friends until his passing as well. She now lives in New Mexico. She was in Ohio at the time. So I joined his fan club, and they had wonderful – I still have all my yearbooks. You know, you see them on eBay occasionally now, but I have the 67 yearbook, the 68 yearbook, you know, and all the newsletters and everything that came. So one year, Leonard decided to offer his fans some of his photographs. These were taken by him, developed by him personally in his dark room, matted by him, signed by him, and they cost a whopping $3 through his fan club.
Wow.
So,
wow.
A sign of the times. And so
well,
I said,
it's not just that. I mean, think about how much they would be worth today. I mean, just a lot.
I had one appraised $2,000. From my $3 investment.
I think that it should be worth more than that.
I have some that are.
Good.
But that was my very first one. That one is a small one. I have some larger ones. So I bought that for $3, and yes, it was recently appraised. And it's maybe 9x6 or something like that. It's one of the smaller ones. So that's right. How I started the photography was back in probably – that was 1973 probably. I was 15, paid the $3 for that. So and I liked his photography. Now, at that time, he was more of a observational photography. He took photos of from his travels or from landscapes and things like this. It was before he made the turn into conceptual photography. I'm very pleased. But now I think I have probably 12 of his photographs and all that I've purchased over the 35 years. And I did sponsor a photography exhibition that included my photographs along with several others. Leonard gave me permission to do this exhibition along with his good friend Rich Michelson in the year before he passed away. And it was the first exhibition, photography exhibition, that was done following his passing. So I felt really honored that Leonard gave his go-ahead for that and his consent. And that was another aspect of our friendship that I'll always appreciate. His other showings, you know, exhibitions were in Salt Lake City in New York. In Los Angeles, you know, at the Hammer Museum, and you know, he's got his photographs are in the permanent collections, you know, of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, you know, and the New Orleans Museum of Art. You know, he is in some, you know, the reputable, you know, outstanding. He didn't need Burlington, North Carolina, for an exhibition, you know, he didn't, but he said, you know, that's fine. And it was a resounding success, but it will always be bittersweet. He gave his permission in, you know, 2014, and the exhibition opened in April of 2015. Of course, he passed away in February. Yeah. So 2 months. He didn't quite live to see it. So that will always be bittersweet, but his gallerist and good friend, Rich Michelson, did tell me, Bonnie, this is the first exhibition nationally since his passing, and he would have been very proud of it. So,
well, that's fantastic.
That was, yeah.
Did his photography inspire you to become a photographer, or were you already interested in that as a different thing? You know, and then you just it sort of was a synergy.
I'm not a photographer. That's a very good question. I appreciate photography, and I did curate the show in terms of with another individual who worked at the gallery that I had the show at. So I think I've always had an artistic bent, and I've been interested in the presentation of it and the composition of it. So I think lean more toward the curating type of interest as opposed to being a participant. But I always appreciated Leonard's eye, and he was very passionate about his photography, and that was very infectious. And he chose wonderful themes later on when he went into his conceptual photography. His first series was called Shekinah, which was the feminine aspect of God. And you know, obviously, women were very interested in this, and in some cases, the religious institutions in other areas within Judaism were not so thrilled about this because things are very patriarchal, you know, in many religions. And yeah, yeah. Leonard was pretty much saying, why is every religion patriarchal? You know, I think there should be more feminine aspects to God. And the Shekinah is, in Judaism, that is the feminine aspect of God. So he did a whole series of photographs based on what that deity should look like. And it was very well received. Again, a very interesting concept. You know, the next concept and portfolio that he did was called the Full Body Project, and this was a celebration of women who were overweight. He said he was tired of women being judged by their size. And that he did not agree with this, and he felt this was minimalizing what women were and what they could contribute. And he did a whole book and portfolio with what one would call healthy, obese, what have you, models. And he said, these are women too. And so he put, you know, that was another concept that he championed. And so, you know, who's not going to like a guy that says, you know, God is not just one thing, is many things, and women should not be judged by how they look. You know, I mean, wow, you know, this guy was a feminist's dream or a humanist's dream, you know. Mm-hmm. So this is why I got passionate about his photography, and I'm just saying tip of the iceberg on these things. He had many other concepts in his photography that were really outside the box and really broke the ice in so many areas. The gallery here that was featured, this was the first exhibition that had nudity. You know, we're in the Deep South.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It doesn't go over very well.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And so the gallery, it's called Alamance Arts. The arts, they basically, we all had discussions about it, had discussions with Rich Michelson, and we just said, we're going to take a stand, and this is going to be an exhibition, and we're going to include you know, the nudes that Leonard did as well, because this is part of the process. This is part of what he's trying to say. Mm-hmm. And so Rich and I later were laughing, saying, you know, by golly, even after his passing, Leonard is still, you know, breaking barriers.
Turning
and
heads.
Through. You know, we broke another one down here. And there were some folks that were really worried about protests and everything, and it went fine. You know, I mean, so now they can't say, ooh, we can't do that here.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. People came from 16 states, 32 different cities, and 5 different countries to see this exhibition in Burlington, North Carolina.
That's amazing.
That's the power of Leonard Nimoy's work.
So, Faith has joined us.
Hello.
All right, so you were just wrapping up talking about some of his different concept photography, Bonnie.
Yes.
So those, the full body project and then the image of God as a woman, those were your standouts for his work?
Yes, and I think because Leonard knew that I appreciated his photography and that we could talk about it was just added another dimension, I think, to our friendship. And I guess the piece de resistance was he had an exhibition that was going to be open at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, which is the largest museum of contemporary art in the United States. It's up near the Berkshires. I made the mistake, being from North Carolina, saying the Berkshires.
Oh.
Everybody up in Massachusetts. So up in the North Adams, Massachusetts, is where it's located in the western part of the state.
Well, he had been invited to have an exhibition there, and it was going to be called Secret Sales. Well, I found out about this, long story short, through actually at a convention in Boston in 2009, but that's another long story. And I decided I wanted to go up and see this exhibition of Secret Sales. What Leonard did was invite people to come to one of the galleries up in Massachusetts, the Rich Michelson Gallery, come as the person you really are or the person you would like to be, and I will photograph that. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Mm. Yeah. People showed up, and all kinds of, you know, people wanted to be a rock star showed up dressed like a rock star. People that were secretly had been presenting themselves as straight but were really gay came out during this process. People that had were timid showed up with chainsaws. I kid you not. It was great, and he photographed them and then videotaped his interview as to their secret self, as to what was going on. Why did you choose this particular prop? Why did you, you know, what? Explain yourself here. And so the exhibition had these photos and the interviews running concurrently. It was great. So these people really did come to life for you. So I knew this exhibition was going to be up there, and I called the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, and I said, I'm very interested in this. Can you give me some information? They indicated on that there were sponsorship levels for this exhibition that they wanted the public to be involved, and I think Leonard had wanted the public to be involved. And they said, well, there's one level that will that includes having your own portrait taken by Leonard Nimoy as your secret self. I said, whoa, sign, yeah. You know, the checkbook's out, you know, because I followed photography for all these years. To actually have my own portrait, secret self-portrait, done. I wrote the check. I sent it up there. And when Leonard found out that I had, it turned out I was one of the primary sponsors. Had no idea. I ended up being one of the primary sponsors of the exhibition. I found out this later when someone said that one of the primary sponsors is going to be Bonnie Moss. He went, oh, my God, I know her. He said, I mean, in a good way. he said, I know her. We've been in touch since I was Spock. And that's what one of the director of the museum told me later, that he was just – He got a kick out of it, you know. So I got to have my portrait taken by Leonard Nimoy. Went up to the museum, and it was that morning. And, of course, you go into this room that was part of the museum. He had all the cables and cameras set up. And, of course, the cables were all over the floor. You're trying not to trip over anything. And he had gone digital at this point. Secret Selves was the first exhibition where he used a digital camera. So he had computers and all kinds of things like that set up. And of course, every time I would, you know, see him, you think you're going to be cool, calm, and collected, and you're not. You know, you're just not. So I walk in, and he's with Rich Michelson, his good friend, who's also his curator, and that was his photography curator. And so I walk in, and so he crosses his arms and he says, okay, what's your secret self? You know, and that voice kind of like, all right. And so I said, well, I did well in school. I went on to college. I did well in college, went on to graduate school, did well in graduate school, went on to postgraduate school. He said, oh, you're a professional student. I said, well, kind of, but in all of that process and studies and this, I forgot to get married. And he went, you forgot to get married? And I said, yeah, I forgot to get married. So he goes, oh. And I said, so my secret self is a bride. And he went, I get to do a wedding? I've never done a wedding. I'm a photographer and I've never done a wedding. He loved it, just absolutely loved it. So he said, this is great. This is great. So I bought this little bouquet, and I bought this little ring of flowers. And he goes, this is great. This is great. So he says, all right, Bonnie, go over to the screen. You know, so I'm going over there. And he says, okay, hold the bouquet up like this. Hold this. You know, do this. And I'm like, I'm being directed by Leonard Nimoy. This is just awesome. You know, so... and, of course, I'm trying not to trip over cables. And, of course, there are arc lights and all this stuff, you know, that you know is there on sets, but you don't really know until you're trying to get in the right, you know, the right spot and trying to act natural when you're in a very unnatural setting. And then he kind of stopped. And I'm like, oh, my God, what? And then he goes, Bonnie? I said, yes. He says, your bra strap showing. That's a friend. When someone would tell you that your bra strap's showing. I said, thank you, Mr. Nimoy. I always called him Mr. Nimoy, even though he would not have minded my calling him Leonard. So I fixed the bra strap. I said, is that better? He went, yeah, that's a lot better. So snap, 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 snap. And of course, I'm getting, you know, still nervous, but trying to. And then he stops again. And I'm like, he's Bonnie. Yes. He said, you know, a wedding is a happy occasion. And I went, yeah. He says, it's a happy occasion. You know, like a bar mitzvah. I'm like, well, I haven't had one of those, but I would imagine so. So then I kind of, that made me laugh, which is, of course, was what he wanted. And he snapped the thing of me snapped the photo of my laughing. So anyway, that was truly a highlight. And of course, I got a copy of that photo, which he signed for me, which is fantastic. But that was quite the experience. Am I talking too much? Am I just prattling on?
No, this is exactly.
I'm with you right now, and I'm also commiserating. So, because okay. I understand what it's like to be in a photo shoot and have to like dodge wires and pretend you're in a natural pose and fake it, and then make it look good for the camera, and whole time you're sitting there going, "Oh God, please don't let me fall flat on my face. I'm going to do something really awkward."
Exactly, and by that time I was obsessing about my bra strap, you know, for the rest of the week. You know, so after that photo session, there was some downtime before he had another commitment. And I mentioned to him, I said, I've brought several things, you know, I've collected on you for years. And he went, oh, yeah, you know. And I said, I wanted to show you some things if you have a moment. He went, yeah. Well, of course, I had flown up there, so I could only take a few albums or photos or whatnot. So I pulled them out of a thing. There are pictures of us. I don't know, David, I may have emailed you one of them, where we spread the photographs I had brought up from his different parts of his career out on a table. And for the next 45 minutes, just he and I went through his career in those photo albums. You know, we talked about all of his different roles. You know, he had different things to say about, you know. When I finally got to a photo, most of them were him, you know, in roles other than Star Trek. When there finally was a shot of he and William Shatner, he went, well, there's Billy. He always called him Billy. every time I saw him, it was Billy. Never Bill, never William, Billy. And I could go into more detail about that, but we talked about his roles in Baffled. We talked about his roles in A Woman Called Golda. He did that with Ingrid Bergman. That meant a great deal to him because he was a huge Ingrid Bergman fan. Casablanca was his favorite movie. Said some things that I didn't know during that 45 minutes. But that was, again, another highlight with him, to just, you know, two people chatting about a career. And he pulled some of the photos out to look at them closer, you know, and it was obvious he had not seen a lot of them. It was obvious. And I learned when he pulls something out of a folder or whatnot and looks at it and really looks at it, he wants it, you know. So I'm sitting there going, Mr. Nimoy, do you want that? Oh, yeah, okay, thank you. And he sets it aside, you know. So he ended up with quite a few things from that little discussion. But as a result, he signed quite a few things for me. So it was quid pro quo, and which was great. But he took a photo of he and Ingrid Bergman. He really wanted that. Took several photos that I had of he and his wife, Susan. He was very sentimental about photos of the two of them. Mm-hmm. And so he took several of those. Maybe one photo from Baffled, because he liked Susan Hampshire, the British actress, a great deal. He was kind of an Anglophile. He liked a lot of British actresses and you know, just that kind of things, English thing, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. English actors in particular. And I will shut up now. As you can tell, I can kind of just go. But those are some of the special moments.
Sure. And that's
really
that's,
cool with Leonard. Yeah.
Sure. And that's why I wanted to have you on there. So you could tell these like personal stories about Leonard and your time you spent with him. Because I haven't gotten to speak with anyone who spent a whole lot of time with Leonard. Faith got to meet him at a con several years ago.
Briefly. I had the opportunity to meet him in 2009, but I was too scared to actually meet him that time. So I stood from afar and like and just admired and like, oh wow. I met Brent Spiner that year though, but I was too too chicken to meet him. And then in 2013, I was actually cosplaying that year, and I was like, you know what? I need to do it this year, because if I don't do it this year, there's a chance I could never do it again. Because at that point, I wasn't sure if I wanted to continue coming to the conventions. I was reconsidering cosplay because people are not very nice. And he was the first person I actually went to go see on the Walk of Fame. I remember standing in that line for like 2 hours that morning. It went by so fast, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to go and do this. Mm-hmm. And then I got to actually meet him, and he was such a sweet man. Because I told Dave and Guy about it. The guys in front of me were very critical about the costume I was cosplaying, just not very nice. And apparently he overheard some of the comments that were made and was very supportive about, you know, you should continue doing this. I think you're absolutely beautiful because you're doing something that you want to do. And that... Mm-hmm. That was my pivotal moment. That was the moment of, you know what? This person that could have never even seen me, I'm just an ant in the world to him, took notice of me. And he took a picture of us together. I've got mine somewhere. I've been trying to find it. I'm not sure if I still have it or not. I lost a lot of computers over the last couple of years. But he was the first person that ever wanted to take a picture of me. So that's why I kind of always remember that, was because he was very, you know, very supportive and very inspirational. And I remember being so scared of him. And then I walked away and it was just like somebody giving my soul a hug.
Yes. Oh, an apt description. Very, very, very true. Very true. An apt description. And I'm so glad you went on and did it. Because I have seen people just burst into tears, you know, when they see him. You know, they just...
That was me. That was totally me. He ended up hugging me, and I absolutely just lost it. I was like, I've admired you for years. Everything that you have done has kept me going and inspired me that, you know, in spite of the world being so toxic, you can still overcome it and be a bright spot in it. And... Yeah, no, he's been and still is my inspiration, that no matter how things get, that you can still find a better way. Yes. I mean, that is one of the biggest things that I have learned and admired about him.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, he was sincere. I mean, he was not just human. He was a humanitarian and a philanthropist, and he really cared about the fans. He really cared about the fans.
Oh yeah, you could tell that there was a lot of love for us, and you can see it in the way he interacted with everybody. That's kind of why I had the courage after waiting in that line. Say what?
And a love for the franchise too. He was sort of the keeper of the flame for the franchise. I mean, I remember when 2009 Star Trek came out, you know, or was coming out, and and a lot of the words were, well, but Leonard Nimoy is going to be on in the movie, and a lot of us were like, oh, good, well, okay, it can't be bad, because he has not endorsed a number of movies and a number of things that have happened he has not been involved in, but if he's coming back to this one, yeah. But if you stick to this one, then, okay, we can take a deep breath because it's probably going to be okay because he wouldn't do it otherwise.
Yeah,
that's
right. It wasn't bad either. I mean, it really was. I mean, the second one, not so much, but the first one wasn't so bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I actually really rather love that movie. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things. But yeah, the fans, the franchise, it was interesting. We were just talking about this earlier today. My little group and I were talking about this because we were talking about Nana Visitor, who is very open and loving with all of the fans. And I said, there's a certain group of them, of these actors, who are very much not quite realizing what they got themselves into. And then there's a group who... Oh, okay. I'm part of this thing. This is a big, huge thing. And it's all of us in the same boat together. And it sort of started with Leonard. I mean, you see a lot of them doing this now, but what you see them doing is you see them patterning. Oh, okay. You know what? Leonard Nimoy really embraced the fans and embraced this. You can sit there and fight it, or you can embrace it. And so we were saying that with Nana, she was doing that too. She was so open and interesting and engaging, and it was the same with Leonard, just engaged with all of us. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm. He was interested in us, which was amazing. He was actually interested by everything that he engaged with in life, which was an aspect that, yeah, I just actually came to that realization listening to you guys. I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, because we weren't, you know, especially in my generation of Trekkies, you know, because it was not quite that first generation, but that second generation before the next gen, you know, yeah. That was that interim generation. And, you know, we were all kind of notorious for living in our parents' basements and not showering enough and whatever. And if you had gone to those conventions in 84 and 85 and 86,
it smelled bad. You'd
actually kind of feel that, especially if you were short. It was a rather horrible.
That continued until the 2000s, Guy. I hate to tell
you. It did. Well, but yeah, but see, I was 5'2" and 85 pounds in 2000.
Oh, it's okay.
I was really short and little and teeny, and I kept getting crushed.
Did you get beat up a lot?
Yeah, I did at school. I did. Certainly, because I was the one carrying the plastic or the cardboard communicator and cardboard phaser, and
yeah,
I had that on the playground. I was cool, man. But I was
you just couldn't handle your coolness.
But that was.
You were asking me earlier about what it was like the first time around and what you just said about carrying around the card. I remember distinctly in 1967 when I went trick or treating. Mm-hmm. And this really dates it. I went with a friend, his name was Mick, and we went as Bonnie and Clyde because that was the number one movie at the box office at the time. And I had my beret, and much to my delight, I had a cigar.
oh, yeah.
I had a good time with that, and the scarf, and the mid-calf thing. And then, of course, Mick had the fedora and the pinstripes. It looked a lot like Kirk in, you know, why am I blanking on the episode? You know which episode I'm talking about. But anyway, and we were going trick-or-treating, and Mick's dad actually went to the bank and got us bank bags for our candy, you know, that said U.S. Treasury or something.
Oh, awesome.
Nice.
Major cool. Well, James Joyce down the block wanted to trick or treat with us, but he was going as Mr. Spock, and his mom had taped his ears. You know, nobody bought costumes back then, okay? You know, everybody made their own costumes.
I don't buy costumes. I make all mine.
We were cosplay before anyone even had coined the term. His mom had taped his ears, took a tin plate and cut out the logo to go on his chest on a blue shirt, black pants, whom he stuffed into his black rubber boots, you know, where his pants were just stuffed into it. And he had a bucket where he had taken a magic marker that said and wrote antimatter on it. And that's where his candy was going, into the antimatter.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. But we were like, Spock can't go with Bonnie and Clyde. It just doesn't work, you know. And, of course, here's James being very un-Spockian going, but I want to go with you guys, you know. And I just remember that very distinctly, the Halloween of 1967.
Nice.
And I think we eventually let James go if we could come up to the doorway separately. You know,
different waves.
Just pretend you're on the holodeck.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And then Spock would come up after we had departed. So anyway, flashbacks.
He'd beam in later.
Yeah, the good old days.
So I wonder how many years I went as in Starfleet uniform or as Spock, and my mom had to do the same thing because in the 80s we didn't have. I mean, even if it was. Even if there was costumes, they were horrible. They were horrible costumes. They were made of plastic or
that's
whatever.
True. That's
and
true.
So,
and not flame retardant. You know, they didn't think so much of they didn't worry so much about that back then. We could have gone up in flames, and you know, it was your own fault back then.
Well, if you're on fire, you'll trick or treat faster.
And I remember we were talking about this also today because I was at Starfest, which is the Denver convention. And I've been going to Starfest since 84. And so we were talking about, well, what's your earliest memory of Starfest? And I was like, oh, buying those rubber ears that they made in the 80s that just encased your ears. They stuck out like TIE fighter things or something, or like Princess Leia's buns. I don't know. It was just horrible. They were these horrible things. And, you know, my mom with her eyeliner pencil trying to draw my eyebrows up and saying, hold still, guy. Hold still, you know.
Wow.
You going really to convention.
The overgrown jackrabbit. I mean, that's kind of.
Oh, that was one of my first. And the amazing thing was going to these conventions was, you know, of course, you're getting beat up on the playground for doing this. But here, you're with God among people men. Who are like, hey, okay, that's those ears cool. are horrible. But that's not a bad shirt.
Yeah.
So it was like commiserating with you over the ears.
It was a whole different world.
Yeah. You are allowed to live. Not
I was
only
allowed to live.
Yes.
Allowed to be me.
Yeah.
I think that's coming kind of full circle. I think that that was a lot of what Leonard was also putting into the fans as well, which was we were allowed to be us, whatever that us was, you know, and he liked that. He thought that was interesting, you know,
people's differences in that.
And people are judging Faith for whatever they're judging Faith on, but he didn't because she's who she is.
Exactly.
And then you look at his photography. It's the same thing. He's not judging these people. He's saying what the icons of people. He was an iconoclast. He didn't like icons of what we should think God should be and what we should think women should look like. And so his photography...
What was pretty. What was so beautiful.
Everybody's pretty. Everybody's beautiful. Everybody's interesting. And he really understood that. And that's you know, a nice thing to do with people, I guess.
Absolutely.
It's powerful.
It's very
He lived Idik. You know, he lived it, the infinite diversity and infinite combinations, you know. I mean, and something tells me he would have lived it whether or not that particular, you know, symbol or concept, you know, would have been part of Star Trek or not. But I think that kind of resonated with him, you know, a great deal.
Sure.
I do think he could identify with that because he himself, you know, he said both publicly and privately, you know, I grew up in a tenement. You know, my parents came from, you know, had nothing when they came to this country, you know, from Russia. When I first came to California, you know, he came to California on a train, three-day, three-night train ride by himself at age 18. He came to California, did not know a soul, knew nothing. His parents had already said, this is a disaster, this isn't going to work. You know, they did not support his decision to do this at all. He left brokenhearted, angry parents at the train station. He was by himself. He had virtually no money except what he had in his pocket from selling vacuum cleaners, you know, the summer before. And he laughed about it later, but he said, my mom put me in this wool suit with, you know, saddle Oxfords or something, and I get off the train in, you know, in California, and it's 80-some degrees, you know, and here's this skinny Jewish guy in a wool suit with a Boston accent, you know, and, you know, could anything have been more pathetic, you know? So he lived that too, you know? He was the outsider from the get-go, and got a job in a boarding house, you know, roomed in a boarding house and scooped ice cream for the first, you know, couple years he was there. So this guy's been there, you know, he had been there, you know. And some people try to forget all of that, and he did his best to remember all that.
Right. He was very grounded.
Yes. Yes. Indeed. And when you had and Faith, you can speak to this too. When you had a conversation with him, it was never about him. It was about he would pepper you with questions. You know,
he's like, what do you want? What's your dreams? What do you want to do with this?
Yeah.
I was so weird to be asked, you know, why did you cosplay this character? You know, because I showed up as Lulu from Final Fantasy X, and he was like, well, why did you choose her? I was like, because she's a strong, beautiful woman that makes her own way. And he was like, well, isn't that who you are?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah.
And it was just like a light bulb for me. And I was like, oh, wow. But yeah, no, he was very interested in who you are and what you're doing. And I stopped being afraid because I had to keep thinking. It was very interesting.
He always kept the attention on, you know, on someone else. And, you know, even at conventions when people would line up to ask him questions in the broader, you know, auditorium or ballroom, you know, 9 times out of 10, if they asked him a question, he would ask a question back.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes, I saw that in the panels. Like, that was amazing, too.
Yeah.
You know, where are you from? You know, what do you do for a living? Or where'd you come from? He was unique. He really was unique. I don't think just among the Star Trek cast, but I think among public personas in general, in terms of his the loyalty that his fans had towards him, the diversity of his talent. I mean, this guy was a guy who was an actor, a producer, a writer, a poet, a photographer, a playwright. He did it all. He literally did it all.
Yeah, and he was great at everything he did.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of started talking about cons a little bit just a little while ago. How did you become involved with the Larry's Con of Wrath documentary?
Ah, yes. I started going to conventions back in the early 70s. And, of course, as young as I was back then, you know, you didn't board a jet to go to, you know, Chicago or Vegas or New York. You went to local cons, which in retrospect, I'm so grateful for that experience, you know. Conventions in Roanoke, Virginia, conventions in Greensboro, North Carolina, conventions in, you know, just smaller venues, which back in the day, you know, you paid your $10 to get in, and as many photographs, as many autographs, as many, you know, conversations you wanted to have with the guests on the sofa or, you know, in the snack room or whatnot that you could have. You know, nothing was piecemeal back then.
That's awesome.
One stop shopping. You pay and you go in. So when the convention in Houston, what was it called? The Ultimate Fantasy came up in 82. That was a big deal because that was the very first convention where the entire cast was going to be there. This is before all the Grand Slams and before all the, you know, the Vegas cons got big and things like that. So this created a lot of buzz. The entire cast, that was just unbelievable. At that time, if you could get one Star Trek, you know, cast member at a convention, two maybe, big deal. The entire cast, unheard of. So people were, and I was in graduate school at the time, early mid-20s, and just said, I've got to go, to this to see the entire cast. And it was right around the time that Star Trek II was getting ready to come out, you know, very highly anticipated, because we so wanted it to be better than the first movie. We were like, please make it better than the first movie. And thank God it was. And so
please, no more 30 minutes of long-tracking shots.
Yeah. I mean, thank goodness. I'll have to tell you about my meeting with Nicholas Meyer another time and Harve Bennett and some of those types. But anyway, so I went down there with, as is frequently the case with cons, a friend of mine from Massachusetts was coming down, a friend from Texas was coming up. You know, we were all converging on Houston. These were all pen pals. You know, no internet back then. No.
You had to be dedicated back then.
You wrote to your Star Trek friends and waited for a letter in return. So there were three of us that were going down there to meet there. And the fourth was actually from I think she was from Boone or she was from Western North Carolina. Her name, she was a nurse. Anyway, well, long story short, of course, it got down there, and it was just the biggest fiasco of all time. You know, the money was misappropriated. All of our hotel rooms were taken. We had paid all this money up front, then ended up with nothing, you know. And, of course, Larry, the bulk of Larry's documentary will be what happened, you know. So people, you know, got there and essentially didn't have rooms, didn't have any money to get additional rooms. This was back when, you know, parents didn't hand their kids credit cards either, right, you know. Right. You know, you had what cash you had on you, and then, of course, you couldn't communicate. So Larry did interview me for the convention, but it was a convention like no other because literally there was no money to pay the stars. There was no money for us to get rooms. The dealers knew nobody had no money, so they weren't going to do well. So what to do? And that's going to be really the essence of Larry's film and how people either sank or swam under those circumstances. So I think it's going to be a fascinating film. But how I connected with Larry and how the, you know, I went to the Las Vegas Con in 2011, and I had heard of Larry through some of his books and some of his, you know, other pursuits. But I was walking around in the, you know, the dealer's room, blah, 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 blah. And then I see this table that says, "The Con of Wrath, were you there?" And I'm like going, holy bleep. You know, I didn't think anybody remembered that con. You know, it was such a debacle, you know. My God, nobody had even talked about this con. It was just like the big, you know, nobody went, you know, shudder, you know, as to this thing. And I'm like, who in the – and I knew it was that convention because that by the end of the convention, the dealers were selling buttons that said the Con of Wrath. You know, because, you know, the Wrath of Khan premiered during that time. Mm-hmm. Everybody at this convention was going crazy. It was immediately dubbed the Khan of Wrath. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, my God. Well, there was this guy with a beard sitting behind the table, and I walked up, and I just slammed my hand down, and I said, I was there. And Larry Nemechek stood up and went, oh, my God, you're the first person here. That was there. Oh, my God. And the rest, as we say, was history. So it's like, sit down.
I can, you know, see Larry doing that.
I could, too. I just got the mental image.
It's just like, huh?
And so he's, you know, sit, you know. So that's how Larry and I met for the first time face to face, and then we stayed in touch, and then I had suggestions, and then I wrote a few checks, and then he had suggestions, and then he's like, okay, you got to be, then I wrote in a check, and then he said, okay, you got to be a part of this, you know, now I want to interview you, and so on and so forth. So I came back in 2013 to Vegas, and he interviewed me for the documentary, and I said, is any of my stuff going to make it? And he's like, are you kidding me? You're going to have to censor some of it. And he's like, oh, no. So Larry and I might be in some negotiations. I don't know.
It's like, can we cut away?
I had talked to a number of people. I work the con circuits here, so I usually am in the staff of a lot of these conventions. And I was talking to one of the con chairs at one point in time for one of the old cons here in Denver. And I said, you know, it seems like such an obvious name. Why is it nobody's ever named their convention the Wrath of Khan? And her face went white, and she's like, you need to look into a Houston convention called the Con of Wrath. And I'm like, okay. And this is, you know, as I looked into it. So there is an echo of that that's just still passing from generation to generation.
No.
And the con chairs all know this. They're all like,
no.
We don't talk about that one.
You've spoken the name that should not be uttered.
That happens at Dragon Con, and Animazement all the time. They're like, shh, don't say that right now.
He should not be named. Don't say his name, otherwise he'll come and find you.
It's like when it's supposed to be a nice day, it looks cloudy, everybody's like, it's going to rain. No, no, shh.
It's McGrath.
It's okay. I'm just strangling
when
you.
When I saw the table,
okay.
I was like, who the hell rented a table to talk about this thing, you know? And then I realized, you know, someone's making a movie about it. Oh, my God. You know, and then my first reaction was horror. And then it was like, this is great, you know, because it is such a, you know, it's such either people don't know about it or they have the experience you had, Guy, or, you know, or those of us that, you know, it was just a very unique experience in I was going to say in condom, but that doesn't sound right.
No, that doesn't quite
work. No, but it's awesome in its own way.
You know, for the new con goers and that, and the people that are fairly new to what the conventions can offer, I actually would suggest that being one of the things that they sit down and have as mandatory reading or watching material before they ever go to a con. To give them a heads up.
Yeah.
I agree. And I'm going to learn something from this documentary because Larry has dug deep enough to find out why things went wrong. You know, when you were a participant, you know, we didn't know what we didn't know in terms of why things went so horribly wrong. And right. Larry has, you know, opened up some of the, you know, Pandora's boxes here to find out, you know, what did go on behind the scenes. So I'm going to be as fascinated as anyone watching this to find out, you know, what really happened.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's going to be great.
I'm looking forward to it as well because, like I said, you know, she had said to me, you need to look into this. And all I found was there was this horrible convention. And that's all I really got. I mean, over the years, you piece a little bit more together and a little more together, but it's still... It's going to be a great thing for me. It's probably like, finally, I know what she was talking about.
Yeah,
he's got a really good point about that because you only really hear snippets about it here and there. And it's like the worst amount of tantalizing details, and some of it doesn't match up. And you're like, okay, so how much of this is crap? And how much of this is really what happened? And if it's all not crap and it really happened?
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, like, wow.
Yeah.
Well, and we've seen conventions here. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, guys.
We've seen conventions. I've been doing working conventions for 25 years now. So I mean, I've watched conventions here in Denver. They'd get started, and then somebody would go, oh, "I just made $1 million," and walk off, and the convention would completely collapse. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that happen. Unfortunately, more times than I'd like to say, you know, while working these conventions, you'll hear all of a sudden, uh-oh, we've got problems or whatever with this convention or that convention. I've been blessed. I haven't actually been on the staff of a convention that collapsed on itself. Mm-hmm. But it's unfortunate that it happens, but it does happen. I think I think it'll be really useful to have this video because like Faith said, we can just say, oh, you want to start a convention? First, watch this video.
This is how not
Here's
to do a convention.
Your experiences. And then we have a short mediation period.
Right. That's right.
Because honestly, the conventions, you guys have a lot more time in it than I do. I've only been doing this for about a little over 10 years now. And I've seen it go from very warm, open atmosphere where, you know, people are very accepting and all of that. And now you've got all these watchdogs. They're like, well, you can't dress like this. You can't do this a certain way. People aren't allowed to take your photos at certain, you know, what? Mm-hmm. You're dressed up in a costume. You're going to a convention. They're going to take your photo. Otherwise, you should be in jeans and streetwear. What? Not our fault. You chose body paint.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that it's just size. The immaturity.
I think that's size. Because we've got a couple of cons that are really tiny but old. Mm-hmm. And those rules don't show up. But the one that I mostly work on in DK is one of the massive ones. It's a big enough one that people come to us from California and come to us every year from Maine and Alaska and stuff like that. And we've got massive numbers of people. And so we have all of those. We have these epic rules, rules after rules after rules after rules. When we were little in 1997, when we were this little teeny convention and we had 215 people, we didn't have a lot of stuff, you know? And
you know what
I was
talking?
Conventions that are around now, the little guys don't have all those rules. And it's a lot of it is, I was head of operations for a very long time. A lot of it is you learn your lesson the hard way when you have to call in the Denver police and you have to call in the Denver paramedics and you've got some crying 14-year-old in operations. You learn the hard way and you never want that experience again. So you make a rule the next year. You know, you never want that to happen again. That's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It's traumatic to all of us. We just do our thing, and then we all of a sudden, hey, you know, it'd be fun. We could do a convention, and then the reality of the world hits you, and you're responsible, and that's kind of dramatic. So, you know, there's two sides to it. I'm not trying to justify it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to justify it in a way.
That's understandable, though, because like one of the things that when I was first brought into the convention scene and that, and I actually wanted a cosplay. I was mentored, and I was advised that, you know, when you go to a convention, you don't go by yourself. You bring a handler. There's somebody there to assist you at all times. They carry your repair kit. You never, ever, ever, ever go to a convention with less than one other person with you. You just don't do it.
Yeah.
Whether it's a small one or a big one. If it's a big one, you have 2 to 3 people with you. They don't teach them that anymore.
Yeah. And that's one of those I wish they had. Like I said, we've had more than one incident with the young girls in operations, and you've got the Denver police and you've got the Denver paramedics and there's blinking lights and
lots of sirens, lots of scared people. And it's not a fun situation for anybody.
And the poor girl is terrified out of her gourd and you're trying to calm her down. You're trying to get it, you know, and that's just a miserable situation. And how did we get to the dark side of conventions from Leonard Nimoy? Because really, Leonard Nimoy was a bright side of conventions.
He was the bright side.
Leonard Nimoy was actually, and honestly, Bonnie as well. You guys are the reason we still have them in spite of these things happening.
That is true.
And on behalf of all cosplayers in my generation gap, thank you. We wouldn't have what we have now if it wasn't for your guys' dedication and your loyalty and your love of this. You guys gave us a gift that we have to take care of and protect. We're not doing a very good job of it right now, but we're going to try harder.
Wow. Wow. That makes me feel better about being a relic.
A relic. A legend.
A legend.
Predecessor.
Most definitely a legend.
You guys are the ones that set the bar for everybody else. And it is a high standard, but it is what is necessary for this industry to continue. It really is.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and that's appreciated by every one of us who were there from the beginning and kind of stoked the fires until Star Trek was reincarnated again and again. You know, those years between when the original series ended and the next gen came along or the movies came along, we were the ones that were still writing and sending around the zines and the newsletters and on poor mimeograph machines, you know, and sending the chain letters, you know. You know, all of that stuff, and joining the fan clubs and keeping the fan clubs going and everything. But I will also say now, it's also the podcasts like this that keep it grassroots that I'm very pleased to see that's continuing. I mean, you've got to keep the grassroots going. Star Trek can't just be a business. It has to be about the people and what people feel. About Star Trek, not just about what you can make off of Star Trek. And
it's not just an industry; it's more than that.
Correct. And that's the, you know, again, not to get back to the more negative things, but you know, when you remember going to the conventions in 73, 74, 75, where you paid, you know, one price, and you could sit down in the coffee shop with Jimmy Doohan, you know, and talk. Or you could have, you know, 5 photos taken with Nichelle in the hallway. Or you could, you know, it was so much more. And part of that is just it's a different time in general in society, you know. I mean, you know, so part of it isn't just that Star Trek conventions have changed. You know, the world has changed. And,
yeah,
and
it's more society than anything else.
Yeah, and there's more, you know, people have to, unfortunately, be more careful and more, you know, just it's just. Part of it is just the world changing, but of course that has impacted the conventions. And of course the conventions were smaller then when you get more people and you get more, you know. But I do miss those days of sitting on a sofa with David Gerald, you know. And, you know, it was just – and they were so happy to be there because, you know, there wasn't – you know, some of them weren't doing a whole lot else. You know,
they weren't being herded around like animals like they are now at times almost.
Yeah, between there was something and nothing and then something again, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember at one small convention, this still blows me away, there's this little old lady sitting on a sofa with little gray hair and a bun. And I sat down and we started talking and she was just a nice – I said, well, how nice this older generation really gets, you know, is – you know, still into this. And so I got up and then somebody said, oh, you were having a nice conversation with Lee. And I said, Lee, who's that? And they said, oh, you've been talking to Lee Brackett. She just wrote something called The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That little old granny was
amazing.
That's awesome.
Know, you know, who also wrote Rio Bravo, who also wrote a number of screenplays, you know, back in the 50s. That's the type of experience you would have at these older conventions, you know. So, amazing.
To some degree, it's interesting because the culture has changed and everything has shifted.
Correct.
And as I was just having this discussion earlier today, Connor Trenier had said, we came out of the closet in, you know, about the time of Next Gen. Then we got into DS9 and then we came out of the closet. It was no longer beat up guy time because he was carrying around his cardboard phaser and cardboard communicator and all of that stuff. Now it was pretty cool to be a Trekkie. It was pretty cool to be, I mean, at least it was tolerated, you know, but the generation that we were in, and I'm looping myself in with you now, Bonnie, because that generation was the same with me whenever I started going to conventions as well. I mean, there were times where I would just be sitting around and talking to, you know, Mark Lenard and whatever. It just happened. You know, I still have a great memory of Nichelle Nichols. She kissed me right on the cheek. And it's like one of my...
You haven't washed it since.
I haven't washed it since. It's a long time ago. But I mean, you know, those days, they're gone. But the trade-off is that we're no longer persona non grata. You know, we're no longer the afflicted. We've at least got, you know, so we sort of traded. We traded it.
And we got more street cred now.
We got a lot more street cred. But there's a lot more of us now.
Realizing that, wait, for them to actually show up in that costume that they made, wait, it took them how long to make it? I can't do that.
Yeah, it's
how they do that.
Pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, Guy. I mean, we're legit, you know, not just fringe, you know, so to speak. A little more mainstream, still maybe misunderstood, but still in the conversation, you know, not in the shadows, you know, so to speak. And again, to bring it back to Leonard a little bit, he would sometimes get frustrated with some of the large cons, the assembly line-ness of it.
Yeah.
Move along.
Like herded around like animals.
Yeah.
Even the guests and the actors.
Can't talk to them. Because his handlers would be like, don't talk to him, just keep moving.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you couldn't even hand the things directly to him. You had to hand it to the person next to him would hand it to him. I mean, you know, there was even a chain.
And that makes you 10 times more nervous when you're coming to the con as a fan, by the way, because you're like, oh, wait. I feel like I'm being frisked by security three times over before I even approach the table.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And it's like, you're really going to stab Leonard Nimoy with an 8x10 photo? I mean, what are you afraid of?
I mean,
of?
We're creative people, but man, that's pushing.
That's really, really hard.
We appreciate the credit, but man, that's just too much effort.
You know, that's you're really
a lot
not
of us.
Injury with an 8x10, you know. So, but I remember one convention, I had the photo op with Leonard first before the autograph. And he would look at me like, you've got enough autographs of me, you know. And then I'm sure he's thinking, gratis, you know, why are you paying for an autograph of me? But when I went to the photo op, and we always – he could be a little subversive sometimes. We would have our little, you know, voice conversation, you know, but during the photo op. And he'd go, hey, Bonnie, and I'd say, hey, Mr. Nimoy, and I'd say, I have some photos to give you, but they tell us, you know, we can't get that. And I remember one time he leaned back and he went, give them to me anyway.
It's like passing contraband at you or something like that. You just had to sneak it to him.
Yeah.
No so, touching. Okay.
So when I came through the line and I had him, and of course the other person beside him is starting to put his hand out, and he's like, and he took his hand and he took him. So he, you know, he would do that on occasion. Yeah.
That's
he knew
that's
I wasn't
going to
hand him nude photos of me or something. You know, it was going to be something more. You know, I mean, he knew enough of the years that I had a picture for him. It was one he was going to want, you know, that he probably hadn't seen. But I just remember that low voice going, give them to me anyway.
That sounds great. Well, thank
you. Right. I think a lot of the things that we were saying earlier, he was the keeper of the flame. But I think he also liked that aspect, and he wanted to keep it as well.
Uh-huh.
And he knew we were losing it as we were, you know, we were trading off. Like we were, you know, we were talking about before, trading off to this different universe, this different world. It's a scarier world. We have to protect the you know, I hear horror stories whenever I'm in any one of these meetings at these conventions about this other convention where, you know, the fan attacked the guest or whatever, or this other convention where, you know, and it's almost like he liked it better back then and so did we, but don't want to take that risk, you know? So it's like, and so I don't blame him. I kind of miss those days too. You know, the 1984 StarCon Denver, you know, and it's, you know, where I was wandering around getting crushed by a whole bunch of people who really should have showered. and opening
that really sticks in your mind, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I mean, like I said, back then I was like 80 pounds and 5'2", and you know, so I was under the ambient level of
head. That's the downside being under 5'6". If you're 5'6" and under, because I'm 5'4" and I intentionally wear 4-inch heels when I'm at conventions, it only just gets you above that margin level. But
Now I'm 6 foot. I'm okay. But back then I was 12 and I was 6 foot and I was a little guy and all these people were, you know, huge all around me, just massive people.
And you're like armpit level.
Yeah, I'm at armpit level. And that just was horrible. But okay, it enough sucks. With the funny jokes. But I remember, you know, opening the doors to the main events, and there off in the distance was Leonard Nimoy or was Nichelle Nichols or these, and all they were these little teeny people way off in the distance because the main events was so huge. And it was, I've completely forgotten where I was headed with this one, but it was cool. Where I was headed was awesome.
It'll come back to you.
Yeah.
It'll come back to me.
Yes, yes. So.
Well, I really wanted to thank you for coming on, Bonnie. Thank you for spending time with us this evening.
This is
a great show.
Okay, wonderful. Great questions. Seriously, I appreciate your interest, feigned or imaginary or real. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about you know, Leonard Nimoy and about my years in fandom. And like with each of you, you know, that interest and that affection and that philosophy and that approach to life, both the series and Leonard, got me through some difficult times and gave me a life philosophy and a life outlook that, you know, I carry with me to this day. So I see all of us as keepers of the flame, and I appreciate your interest and your attention, and I hope all of y'all will keep on keeping on.
Oh, we most definitely will.
It's been a real pleasure getting to talk to you.
The same to you, all of you. Thank you.
Long and prosper. Is there any way anyone, if they want to, would they be able to find you on social media?
I am NCBonnie1 on Twitter. I don't do a lot of Facebook because I just don't have time to go through all of that. I'm on Facebook, but I have like 10 friends because anything beyond that, I just, you know, I work for a living, you know. But I can do Twitter because it's short and sweet, you know. So so I'm okay with that. So, okay, appreciate you asking.
Oh, you're very welcome. Hopefully people come check it out and just say hey to you on Twitter if they heard this and said, hey, we heard you on Synthaholics.
Okay, good deal. And thank you, Larry Nemechek. Yay.
Yes, thank you, Larry, for introducing us. That was very, very awesome of you. Thank you very much, Larry.
I'm going to be going with Larry on the tour, the Geek Tour.
Oh, the Geek Nation Tour? Oh, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, we're going to be there. So
that's going to be fun.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk to y'all about that when that happens.
Sure, yeah, get you both on.
Yeah.
But you both thought at the same time. That'd be fantastic. Tell us how that was and tell us how the Vegas con was, since I'm not going to be able to make it.
But excellent.
That would be a lot of fun. Yeah. But all our music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com and at Warp 11 on Twitter. You can find us online at Synthaholic Duo on Twitter. I am at David_J_Duncan.
You can find me at Faith Hertzberg at Twitter and the same on Facebook.
You can find me at USS Tamerlan on both Twitter and on Facebook.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. Live long and prosper.
We'll cry till we laugh, and we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had.